So it was many moons ago in early spring that I found myself on top of one of the foothills that surrounds the Rockies, the Canadian Rockies in southern Alberta. I had climbed up into those foothills that day, and I had climbed up there with a sleeping bag and a sleeping pad and a bottle of water, and that's all I had. And I sat there on the top of that foothill, and I looked to the west so that I could see the dark descend upon the day. It had been a very clear and a very crisp day, and the evening was also very clear and very crisp, which also meant that it was very cool and very cold. And so I took that sleeping bag and I wrapped it around me just as tight as I could to stay warm as I entered into that night. And I looked out to the west. I looked out to the Rockies that were in front of me. And there, as I looked out to the Rockies in front of me, I saw the most glorious of sunsets. Watched the sky come alive with color there as the sun went behind the Rockies. And then as those colors began to diminish, and I looked above and I could see the sky beginning to go purple. And from purple, it went to a very, very deep dark. But before it went to that very deep dark, as I looked out to the place where the sun had set, I noticed for the first time in my life that when the sun sets and light begins to diminish, it doesn't sort of diminish in a flat line like this across the horizon, but it in fact diminishes sort of like the closing of the aperture on a camera. And so where the sun had been, it got smaller, smaller, and smaller, until all around was dark, except for above me, popping like popcorn, were stars going off left and right, as I could almost feel that luminous energy of these worlds millions and billions of miles away that were up there in the sky. When I had climbed that hill, it was part of a 100-acre piece of land that friends of mine owned there in southern Alberta. When I had climbed that hill, I had been kind of a broken person. Not kind of, I was a broken person, distraught, distressed, depressed, in a funk so deep that I could not extricate myself from it. And I went up there, and as I went up there, this broken person, I had gotten there because I had been wallowing so much. I had called my friend in southern Alberta, thousands of miles away, and she had said to me, "Just come." And she made it possible for me to have the airfare to come, and I came to be with these friends of mine that I had spent some summers with. And when I got there and she absorbed the wallow that was me, she handed me the keys to her truck, and she said, "Go up to the land. Go to the land that we had worked on before." And she knew in ways that I didn't know that there was healing to come. Now, Abraham's situation is not mine. The setting of Abraham's life is not the setting of my life, but the scriptures that we had that Maureen was just reading for us tell us of a person who was not a real happy camper going out into the night that night some 3,500 or more years ago. Abraham, if you recall, just for the chapters that are before the ones that we read, had been a person who had lived in this place called Ur of the Chaldees, and he had lived there and had lived a life of existence with his family and his clan, and God had spoken to him and said, "I am going to move you from here to another land. I'm going to take you to a land that will flow with milk and honey. I'm going to take you to a place where you will have family, where you will have descendants." And Abraham had made the choice to follow the word of God and to follow and go to where God would send him. But when he got to Canaan, all was not so well. In fact, the land was not doing so well. It was not a place flowing with milk and honey. And like the generations that would follow him, he had to make his way to Egypt, he and his wife Sarah, in order to survive. And then in Egypt, once he's there, both he and his wife's lives are put in mortal danger. And he barely escapes and makes it back to the promised land. And there he loses his nephew Lot. And life is not good. And worst of all is he has gotten old. And so too has his wife. And he has gotten so old that they are well beyond childbearing years. And so when we pick up the story here in chapter 15, and he's having this conversation with God, he's not a happy camper. He's saying to God, "Listen, you promised. You promised me descendants, and I am left with the children of my slaves. That's all I get as descendants. And God then invites Abraham to step outside. Invites Abraham to step outside into the night. And there, what we are told in the story is God points Abraham to look up to the stars and says, trust me, your descendants will be more numerous than all of these stars. Now, maybe that's what happened. Maybe that's exactly what happened. Maybe all Abraham needed at that moment was just to be reminded of God's promise. And maybe it happened that quickly, but my guess is it was not something that happened so quickly. My guess is it wasn't so much that it was about counting the stars. It wasn't so much about being able to see all the descendants that would come. My guess is out there in the night, in the still of that night, underneath all of those stars, Abraham was able to finally relax into the presence and the promises of God. And the story that we have given to us is of that, of his being able to, in fact, trust in God's presence. And ironic, isn't it, that so often we find ourselves able to have those moments of revelation where the world quiets down enough that we can trust in God's presence, and we have those revelations at night. Because we've done a good job of trying to banish the night from our world. When Edison comes up with the light bulb and gives us this gift of electricity, and what an amazing and miraculous gift he gives us, there were unseen consequences that would come from that moment. Some of the consequences that come from that moment of electricity is no longer did we rise and fall with the rising and the setting of the sun. No longer were our lives centered around the rhythms that God had created when God on that very first day says, I shall make night and I shall make day and it shall be good. And even before electricity, when we sort of tried to gentle our way a little bit more into the night with fire, with candlelight, gathered around to tell stories, gathered around to play games. Today, as soon as the shadows begin to lengthen, we pop on our electrical lights as quick as we can. And we don't just pop on those lights, we turn on all of those devices that we communicate with, that we use to entertain ourselves, and we keep ourselves busy with all of that. And no longer do we do that together. For the most part, we oftentimes go into our own room and we connect ourselves with folks that may be thousands of miles away who we may never know, may never see, may not even have an idea of their name, while right next door, in the room next door, there may be someone suffering and we have no idea of it. And there's reasons why we banish the night. There are good reasons why we banish the night. Our primary sense is that of sight for most of us. Our primary sense is that of sight. So at night, when that sense is taken away, the world begins to feel a lot more unsafe and a lot more vulnerable. And it can be scary because we don't have control over that. We don't have control over that. I love to take people, as you know, hiking out to Kaena Point. And as you know, I love to take people hiking out to Kaena Point so that we get out there in the afternoon, watch the sunset. Now, of course, what that means, if we're going to watch the sunset, is the 2+ miles on the way back are in the dark. And when I take young people out there in particular, and I challenge them to walk back in the dark, to walk back in the dark, to not use their flashlights, to where every single sound is something that is unfamiliar to them, to where there are voices that they had not even heard are there present to them, where there are things that as the, I don't know where it comes from, but it is so absolutely from ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties and the things that go bump in the night, God deliver us. They cannot do it. They can't last 2 or 3 minutes without putting those lights on. And the truth is, it's not just the things that we don't know that are out there that plague us in the night. It is also our thoughts, also the demons, both imagined and unimagined, those material and spiritual, that want to come and plague us. Those demons that during the day we can keep at arm's length, but at night they want to come back and say, are you listening to me? Are you listening? Are you paying attention? I'm right here. I'm right here. Certainly in my deepest of funk, in the deepest of places where I was, it was the night. It was the night that I feared the most. It was the night in which all the things that I could do during the day that kept me distracted, I could no longer hold those thoughts at bay, and they would come rushing in. In the time where I wanted to say, now I lay my head down to sleep, there was no sleep that was coming. There was just all of this agony and angst coming my way. I remember one night, in the midst of all of that, unable to sleep, suffering and struggling, a friend coming into my room. And I looked at that friend and I said, you know, I know the day is going to come where I will look back on this time and I know I will have learned plenty. But frankly, I'm so tired of learning right now. And maybe what it was is I just needed another night like Abraham had. A night in which he walks out there into the light. Into the night, and allows himself to settle into the presence of God. Howard Thurman, the theologian Howard Thurman, perhaps talking about one of his own nighttime encounters with the divine, wrote this: in the stillness of the quiet, if we listen, we can hear the whisper of the heart, giving strength to weakness, courage to fear, hope to despair. I suspect that's what's happening that night for Abraham. Courage from despair. Hope. In that moment, when the life has slowed down just enough, the clamor of the clan, the shepherding of flock and family is no longer for that moment his responsibility. He slows down enough to know that God is present and that all is well. That certainly was the case for me that night in early spring in southern Alberta, in the foothills outside the Rockies. For as the night began to descend and those very same stars that Abraham had seen thousands, millennia of years before were there, a Milky Way going across the sky in such a way that was magnificent and beautiful. And even through the night, just as I watched the aperture of light disappear in the morning, as I turned around, I could see the aperture of light opening up to me. Through that night, in ways that I can't even begin to describe, God became so utterly present to me. Became so utterly present to me that the hurt that I had been carrying was lifted off of my shoulders. The source of that hurt did not go away. I would face the source of that hurt the very next day, but my ability to deal with that hurt had changed. And the chaos that had defined my life, just like there is chaos that is moving across the face of the earth when God first speaks and calls the world into being, that chaos was no longer there. And the presence of God was so very clear and very palpable. And it said to me, you can go on. You can go on. I am here and I am present. And how interesting is it that it takes so often the night for us to be able to hear that and know that. John Taylor, the theologian, said, I have heard things in the dark that I could never have learned in the light. Things that have saved my life over and over again so that there's really only one logical conclusion. I need the darkness as much as I need the light. We need the night as much as we need the day. And this is not just her wisdom. This is the wisdom of the ancients. The Jewish Sabbath does not begin on Saturday morning. The Jewish Sabbath begins on Friday evening when the sun has set and three stars appear in the sky. Thus begins with the night, the holiest of days. For slaves that were escaping from out of the south, it was the night where their safety was, when they could look to the stars and know the direction they needed to know. For the Polynesian voyagers, it was only at night with the stars above them that they could know exactly where they were in the world, to know exactly what was necessary, where they were needed. It is in the night so often that we find ourselves and find our place and find our presence with God. Yet we work so hard to stay away from it. And perhaps if there's any lesson, we need to learn to quit staying away from it at all. Think about the story that Maureen read for us there of Jesus with the Pharisees saying, "Watch out, don't go to Jerusalem. Herod is there and wants to get you." And Jesus knows it's not just Herod who he calls the fox. It's Pontius Pilate, who is a brute. It's Caesar in Rome, who thinks he's God. It's the people in the streets who one day are going to be raising an acclaim for him, and the next day are going to be calling for his head. He knows that all of this is awaiting him. And how does he respond after he says, "You tell that fox what's going on"? He then goes into a lament for Jerusalem, and he says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I wish I could gather you under my wings like a mother hen does with her chicks." You realize, of course, that when the chicks who are in the light gather under the wings, what they are doing is they are going into the darkness that is under those wings. They are going into that night under the wings where they are then able to find themselves together. And they are able to find themselves with the heartbeat of the mother right next to them. It is into the night that we oftentimes have to go. It is into the night that we oftentimes have to go so that we can in fact find where God is present and alive. Let's not forget that when we celebrate the Easter story, it is into a tomb of utter darkness that Jesus is laid in death. And it is out of that tomb that a womb of life and light is formed that he rises from 3 days later. We are a people that understands that it is within the darkness there is life waiting to emerge. Seeds do not just sit on top of the ground. They are buried into the soil, and from out of that darkness of the soil, they will emerge. So our Lenten journey, perhaps what we need to be doing in our Lenten journey is we need to allow ourselves the night. Allow ourselves the night. And it really isn't about absence of light or anything like that. It is about allowing ourselves to settle in to where God is present with us, and we quiet the world around us so that we can know that God is here with us and we are called by name. It was true for Abraham and the descendants that would follow him. It was true for me on that foothill there in southern Alberta. It is true for each of us. God is speaking. God is calling. Whether it be day or night, God is calling to us that we may know that God is present and alive and knows us by name. Amen.